On today's episode of The Good Word with Goodwill, I talked to former Knicks GM and current ESPN analyst Scott Perry. We talk about his time with the Pistons and Knicks, how he as an executive handled trade speculation like Donovan Mitchell and even perhaps Joel Embiid, plus his expertise on how he would handle the James Harden and Philadelphia 76ers situation. All that and much more on today's episode of The Good Word. Welcome to The Good Word. My name is Vincent Goodwill, senior NBA reporter for Yahoo Sports and the host of this podcast. We are also on YouTube and wherever you get your podcasts. So if you see us on YouTube right now, you see the face sitting next to me. That is the man I call Detroit Red. That is former Knicks general manager Scott Perry, who also spent time as a VP with the Detroit Pistons, the Orlando Magic, the Seattle Supersonics, and now Scott is making his foray into media as an ESPN analyst. He's going to be on Countdown. He's also going to be on NBA Today. Scott, you said you would never do TV.
Well, Benny, you are letting a lot of stuff out to start this interview. First of all, the Detroit Red. Very few people know that nickname. Now, you've made that known to the masses that are listening to this program. But first of all, I just want to say thank you for having me on here today and looking forward to a great time with you, as I always have with you. I'm sure it'll be very insightful and it'll be a lot of fun. And I also just want to say to you, just really proud of the work that you've been doing. And I can say to the listening public, I knew him when he was first getting started. So if you need to know more about that, feel free to reach out to me.
I used to get lectured by Scott Perry. I think Scott, when I was a beat writer for the Pistons and Scott was a VP with the Pistons, Scott would take it upon himself to lecture me. I would get these phone calls after practices or after games, and they'd be like, Vinny, nah, what you wrote wasn't bad, but you don't have the whole story. And I'd be like, why do I feel like I'm one of the Cosby kids sitting here getting lectured? But Scott took me under his wing. He showed some mercy on me. And even when I had to, you know, beat the organization over the head a little bit because they had a little drama while we were there, he never really shunned me. So I appreciate that. That's where the Detroit Red nickname came from. If those who know, if you know, you know. I'll just leave that there. If you know, you
exactly.
know.
And you can blame my mom for that phone call. My mom was a journalism teacher, as you know, for 18 years in Detroit public schools, and grew up kind of in that space, if you will, learning a lot from her. So always paid attention to journalism. I have obviously a great deal of respect for what you do and a number of your colleagues do day in and day out.
I appreciate that. So before we begin, for those who don't know, you're going to find out Scott Perry is a huge Pittsburgh Steelers fan. His dad, the late Lowell Perry, was actually the first Black executive in pro sports when he was an executive with the Pittsburgh Steelers. So he has a certain lifelong affinity there. But your Steelers got beat yesterday by the Jacksonville Jaguars. I need to get your thoughts on the state of the Steelers before we even start this basketball stuff.
Boy, Vinny, you really are making it tough for me to stay on this podcast right now, because you know how I live and die with my Steelers. And obviously, a tough game yesterday. But the one thing that does always give me, obviously, I'm a prideful Steelers person, but always gives me hope and some calm is the presence of Mike Tomlin there. He is an absolute tremendous leader of men. And no matter what the obstacles are, and, you know, we're not playing as well as I'm sure first and foremost that he would like to see. But one thing I can assure you of, having been around him a lot and watching him work and his staff work and just the entire organization, they won't run away from the problems. They will run to them until they get them fixed. So short week coming back to play Tennessee here on Thursday. So hopefully the outcome is going to be different come Thursday when we're back at Acrisure Stadium.
Yeah, Scott, you sound like a football executive right there, being very, very calm and presidential. I like that. I like that. I'm gonna tap y'all into Scott, because Scott can go. Scott is always really calm, even when he's not calm. Like, that voice don't only inflect, but so much. I think it's a Detroit thing, because we don't really yell and scream, but you can kind of hear the seriousness in us. So I'm gonna see if I can get Scott to raise a level, because we're gonna talk some hoops here. Scott, right, before we even go to some of the topics of the NBA today, you've got a championship ring. You've been to the finals. You've been to the conference finals 6 straight years as an executive with the Pistons. I'm just curious, because I've never actually asked you this before. Do you have any good Rasheed Wallace stories that you can say on air?
A lot of good Rasheed Wallace stories. And Rasheed, first and foremost, was an awesome guy to work with. I think he was a great teammate to his fellow players, but just was a joy to be around. There never was a dull moment with Sheed, and nobody was safe, as you well know, when you walked into the gym, depending upon what he may have read or what may have transpired the night before. Right now, you know, he and I still stay in touch. I've been avoiding him a little bit lately because he's a huge Kansas City Chiefs fan, and they've been ruling the NBA for a while. So, and with my Steelers not at the level of Kansas City as we currently speak, it's not a good time for me to call him. But, you know, Rasheed, I think what stands out to me a lot, just going to some game moments with him, is how he would, on certain nights, decide that I'm going to launch a left-handed three-point shot in this game tonight. And I used to always think, wow, that took a tremendous amount of nerve, number one, when that's you shooting with your offhand, a three-point shot. But just the amount, then I look back and I used to see him practice it, during practice sessions, and he always talked about that he would do it, to have the skill level to at least even attempt that shot really, you know, stood out to me too. And, you know, during our run when we were so good there in Detroit for, you know, during that decade, what else stood out to me, when we would play the San Antonios or the Minnesotas or Boston with Kevin Garnett, those elite talented power forwards, to watch him raise his game to their level. And that
he was just as talented as all
that
those
was,
guys.
That was a really sight to behold, to see that. Because he was, I think, the one guy on our team that could really elevate to that level. Now, he, you know, night in and night out, he didn't always do that. I think he would be the first to tell you that. But extremely unselfish basketball player. And his knowledge of the game, I don't think that the average fan really knows and appreciates that. And that's why you saw him. And I think he's still coaching a little bit now. I know he's coaching at the high school level. I know he dabbled a little bit in the NBA as well as a coach, to watch him work with big people and share his knowledge, as he used to do when he was playing with us, is really a sight to behold.
Yeah, Rasheed Wallace is a basketball genius, for those who don't know. Like, he's literally one of the smartest players I've ever been around. Like, you can just sit there with him and he can tell you certain intricacies of the game. And you saw that translate when he was a coach for the Pistons for you. I think he was a coach in New York. I think that might have been even before you got there.
Yes.
In 2016. But now think about it, Scott. That team was the only team that I can think of in this new era of the NBA, or max salary era of the NBA, that there was no max salary guy on that roster. And now you're talking about championship teams having to have 2 or 3 max salary players. And you guys did it with 0 max salary players. That was just how rare that was, and how I'm sure that shaped you as an executive in your travel since.
Absolutely. I take the greatest pride in that, and obviously have to give all due respect to the leader of that vision and that time, being Joe Dumars, who was our president. And his belief was that, look, and we all, and I learned a great deal from it. We're not going to wait around here for, you know, some draft pick to fall out of the sky. You know, at the time when we first started in Detroit, the Lakers were the dynasty team. You know, you had Shaq and Kobe there. And Joe's thing was, okay, we may not have one of those two guys in our building, but let's go get deep. Let's try to be too deep at every position and see if 10 could one day go beat two. And that's really how we started going about building the team, was with great depth.
Mm-hmm.
As you well know, we were able to attract a lot of players who were formerly high picks, the Chauncey Billups of the world. We, you know, end up signing him as a free agent, traded for Rip Hamilton, another lottery pick. And for whatever reason, it hadn't worked out at their previous stop or stops in Chauncey's case.
Right.
And gave them an environment and a platform that to say, hey, we really believe in you. This is what we're about. We think you can help lead us there. Those guys bought in. The starter of all that was, you know, when we first came in the door, when we had to trade Grant Hill in that sign and trade when he was leaving as a free agent, and we acquired Ben Wallace, a guy who was undrafted, a guy who was first cut by the Boston Celtics when they were trying him out as a small forward. And I know that's to this day irks Ben to no end, because he felt he never got a chance to even make the team because he was no closer to being an NBA small forward than you or I. And so he goes on to Washington and finally makes a team just through his grit and determination and his toughness, and got a chance to blossom more in Orlando with that heart and hustle team with Doc Rivers coach, yep, where that was a highly competitive, highly efficient defensive team. And Ben played a lot of minutes there, backing up, I think, Bo Outlaw at the time, and really represented what we wanted to establish in Detroit. And you, being from Detroit, Vinny, you know, Detroiters are going to always resonate with tough people, physical play, a defensive mindset, all those things that Ben embodied. So when we were able to get him back, even at the time that deal was made, and obviously losing a great player like Grant Hill, people were thinking it was doomsday for us.
And right.
The fan base didn't know who Ben Wallace was, but without him, that Pistons group doesn't become the Pistons group, because he set the foundation. He set the standard that every night, win, lose, or draw, when you come to play the Detroit Pistons, you're going to be in for a fight. You're going to be in for a battle. And that just resonated to everybody that was in that locker room when he first got there, to when we started bringing the new players in, like we talked about the Chaunceys and the Rips, and then eventually Rasheed, and then drafting Tayshaun. But he set the standard.
Mm-hmm.
And he set the standard for the fan base too, and which was huge, as you know, because Detroiters, especially when it comes to basketball, you know, you got to win there for people to come out and buy in. And they saw that we were a lunch pail team. We were going to put those hard hats on, just like the factory workers were doing all throughout their lives, and they were coming to enjoy the game. You know, that's how the Detroit was built. Just, you know, the auto industry, we were built on tough, hardworking men and women working in, a lot of them working in the factories.
And, yeah.
And our team represented that, and in a big way. And so that was a great lesson for me as a look around the league. I think the teams that do that well,
they represent the area that they're in.
That's huge. You know, that's huge for your guys coming in night in and night out, that, you know, when that fan base can get behind you every single night and help those guys to victory.
Yeah. It's funny, cause you touched on a lot there. It's almost like you were reading my mind, cause I wanted to talk about the connections between the market that you're working in, the team that you have to build. But you first talked about the Pistons trading Grant Hill. And we've seen that so often. Grant was a free agent, and that was a sign and trade thing. So it wasn't like a player asking out. It was the matter of Grant being able to get the max dollars at the time, and the Pistons were able to get something back. Now you're in the era where free agency doesn't really exist as much anymore. Players will get their money from their existing teams and then ask out. That brings us to James Harden, right? Yep. James Harden has quit his job, Scott. He just didn't notify anybody that he has quit his job. Okay, he didn't give him a 2-week notice. He showed up one day, and then he didn't show up, and then he tried to come back because he decided, hey, maybe I can get paid while not playing, right? Not exactly what happened, but for purposes of being funny, that's what he did. He showed up to the airplane. Now, Scott, as somebody who has had to deal with trading Carmelo Anthony when you walked into New York in 2017, and then even before that, when you took over in Orlando in 2012, you had to deal with the Dwight Howard situation. When there is a player who wants out and he doesn't want to play for the franchise anymore, you're a little different than Daryl Morey because Daryl Morey played a part in creating the James Harden situation. With you, you walked into situations that were done before you got there. How do you go about managing the people part of player who wants out? Let me see what I can get back. I'm starting a rebuild, and let me make sure I can get as much as possible while also doing right by the player because I haven't done anything wrong to the player.
Great question. That is one of the major issues of the day for any front office person. And I think it really begins and ends with your ability to communicate openly, honestly, with that player and whoever his small circle may be, whether it be his agent, close family member, whoever that may be. Communication is what is key. So when you're coming new into a situation, you want to try to get that established and say to that player, look, I wasn't a part of what had transpired before, you know, whatever happened before getting there, but you and I are starting off on fresh terms. I hold no ill will. I have no preconceived notions. There's no sides to pick. Let's you and I establish a communication, a dialogue about what you're trying to look to do. Also, I want you to understand what my job is and what I have to do. And let's see if there's common ground. And in terms of being able to trade that player to a place that he may want to go while we're receiving back players or draft picks or whatever the case may be that help our vision in moving forward. It's, to me, it's never about a lopsided deal. It's about a fair deal. And sometimes, you know, all of these situations aren't created equal,
right?
Because you never know what the marketplace is going to look like for said player, especially if the league knows that the player wants out and he's just interested in a handful of players, or how many years does the guy have left on his contract? So in James Harden's situation, he's just, you know, he's on an expiring contract.
Mm-hmm.
So now if you're going to give up a substantial amount for him, you got to know that you're going to, A, that you want him there beyond this year, and B, feel confident that you can resign him and keep him there. So that's a big ask. And then, so on the other hand, there are going to be a lot of teams that may like him as a rental, when I mean by rental, just this season. But if you're looking at him as that, then you may not be looking to give up that much for that.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Because now you rented a player. If it doesn't work out, you have nothing to show for. So there's so many dynamics that go into play here. But I think as a leader of an organization, it is your job to be that leader and set that atmosphere, set that environment on how we're going to handle things. And I would be communicating with this person every day.
Mm-hmm.
Not allowing, you know, I'm not going to just communicate solely through his agent or intermediary. No, we're going to build a rapport. We're going to build a understanding. Somebody's got to be the adult in the room.
Right, right.
Again, to your point, you know, when you early on when you joked about me lecturing you in the beginning, it's not about the lecture. You know, I told you, I'm from a family of educators.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's important to for the guys that I've ever come across in my 23 years in the league, where I can educate them about the business as well. I mean, I think that's important, even though I know ultimately my job was always going to come down to, did we win or lose, you know, did we win enough or lose too much in order to keep your job or lose your job? But just my own personality and who I've been as a person and as an executive, it was always about establishing a great communication foundation that player, no matter what the issue, felt comfortable coming to speak to me, because I was always going to feel comfortable going to him if I saw something that I didn't like or particularly care for. And I think that's hugely important. And I think that's at the center of this whole James Harden conflict right now.
Yeah, communication. And clearly, you know, Daryl Morey is a numbers guy. I'm not saying that to bag on him or anything like that, but he doesn't come from the same world that you've come from. You cut your teeth in recruiting, college basketball, then coming to the league. That's all about communication, relationships with players. And when James Harden comes out and says, I will never talk to Daryl Morey, I haven't talked to him, I'm not going to talk to him, that breach of trust, Scott, how can something get to that point where an executive and a player are not talking for an extended period of time, or there's no lines of communication? That's employee, employer, or peer-to-peer, or respect level from two people. How can something like that get there? I know you're not in that building. You know what I mean? Right. But
yeah, it's tough. You know, and I hate to kind of assume what happened, but to kind of answer your question, though, it's just like in any other relationship. When there's a breakdown of trust, usually someone has not been forthright. Someone is hidden some information from me. Someone that has said one thing, done another. Those are the kind of activities that get relationships to this fractious point.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's what makes it difficult. So, you know, look, I understand, you know, again, I understand how things can get that way. But again, as a leader, that's why the daily communication is so important. And to say, you know, and you mentioned the like Daryl being analytic driven and maybe not people driven. See, we're in an era today that all of this is important. There isn't, you know, I say all the time, analytics have a seat at the table in decision making. Today, it is a tool in the toolbox, but it's not the tool.
Right.
And it always is going to get back to dealing with people, because guess what? People are still playing this game, Vinny. We do not have machines playing this game. So until mm-hmm. that happens, it's machines and you can just plug into a computer and get someone to act a certain way. It's going to always get back to managing people, communicating with people, getting people to buy in to the greater good, you know, greater good for the greater good for the team is going to help make them as individuals successful.
Right.
And that's the key. That's the key to this whole thing. I think I'm going to quote somebody back that you knew well. I don't know if you met him, but when Will Robinson was with the
Pistons. Oh, yeah, of course. The legendary Will Robinson.
Will was a long-term mentor of mine. I knew Will since I was a kid, 10 years old. And people go read about Will Robinson if you don't know who I'm talking about. I mean, he was a trailblazer before his time and coached over 300 kids to Division I scholarships in a variety of sports in Detroit Public Schools. He was Doug Collins's first coach in college at Illinois State. But I remember when I got into coaching and Will Robinson said this to me, and I'm going to stick with this line resonates with me all the time. He said, Scott, basketball is the most unselfish game played by selfish people.
Oof.
It is your job to unselfish those selfish people. So
that's a mouthful there, Scott.
It's a mouthful. It's a simple statement, but it is a mouthful. And again, that is at the core when you're talking about team building. Even, you know, I'm not coaching any longer, but as an executive, you are the coach of the organization.
Mm-hmm.
And you have, and everybody that comes in your organization has dreams, desires, individual goals, wants, objectives. You've got to figure out how you can get all of those people to buy into the collective vision and dream and goal of the team and the organization, and show them in upon doing that, this is how you're going to achieve your own personal goals as well. And I think, you know, that was one thing that we did in Detroit beautifully. Again, Joe was the architect and behind a lot of that. He wouldn't allow the personal agendas to get into the building where it was going to overwhelm the collective and interfere with the collective's goal and vision. And that was becoming champions.
Yeah. And it's funny, you know, Will Robinson was a legendary Pistons scout, part of the Bad Boys. I think he discovered Joe Dumars at McNeese State, you know, so he was a basketball historian, one of the first Black coaches in the history of basketball.
He was the first Division I Black coach.
First Division I Black coach. So just a little history, a quick history lesson there. And Scott, going back to the Harden stuff, however that Harden trade, if ever it happens, like the Clippers are sitting, they're just sitting waiting, right? They don't have to put a great offer on the table. But let's assume that that trade happens at some point. The next logical thing that people are going to say is, what happens to Joel Embiid right now? If the Clippers don't give them back anything of real substance, if they don't give them back anything that Daryl Morey can flip into a superstar player, the next question is going to be, Joel Embiid is going to want out. Scott, you were a GM of the New York Knicks for a long time over there. You were a GM for a long time in a place that does not have a lot of longevity, right? Every superstar player over the past 5 or 6 years that has come up for a trade or free agency, the Knicks name is on the tip of everybody's tongue. So Joel Embiid, if it happens, will not be anything new. But from an executive standpoint, when you're in that chair and you know that there's going to be all this speculation swirling, it was once Donovan Mitchell, it was once Kevin Durant and Kyrie Irving, and it could wind up being Joel Embiid now. How do you handle some of the outside noise inside when there could very well be a desire to go acquire a player of that caliber?
Yeah, great question. I think the coverage, the media coverage, when star players become available, whether it be free agency or trade, the New York name came up well before I started working in New York, and it's going to continue to, you know, on as long as this league is operating. Just, I think that speaks to the power of New York City and just, you know, the franchise being located in the largest media market in the country. But as an executive moving forward today, you can't get caught up into the noise until that becomes a fact that either Joel Embiid himself has said publicly that he would like to be traded, which, to my knowledge, he has not. And he started off well this year, playing great. When I watch the guy play, he plays like a guy who's trying to win a championship in Philadelphia. So until that point comes, you're just kind of paying attention. No, I don't care whether you're in New York, Detroit, Los Angeles, it doesn't matter. You're just kind of paying attention. You're watching their team play, just seeing how that interaction is going. Obviously, if they're winning a lot of games, it stays quiet. If they start to lose, you might watch a little closer. And, you know, one thing that I don't know, well, I don't know the relationship of Joel Embiid and James Harden. And so just how close they are or are not in terms of what James is going through. Because you got to remember, they are fellow players and they're teammates. And so a lot of times, my experience, you know, when one player is going through a difficult time for whatever the reason, a lot of times there's, and rightfully so, there's empathy from their fellow player.
Right.
We're not privy to that conversation, but you know, you just got to be on alert, watching for it, seeing what transpires. You mentioned that they probably won't get a star player back if there's, in fact, there's a deal with the Clippers. I tend to agree with you on that, because if I'm the Clippers right now, to my knowledge, at least from what I've, you know, read and kind of followed through the media, it's a competition of one.
Mm-hmm.
And look, the Clippers were projected to be a top four team in the Western Conference without him. So they're probably right now, is my guess, watching their own team and really studying their team. And the thing that has derailed them a lot over the past few years has been health.
Mm-hmm.
So how healthy they will be, I'm sure they're going to really study this 20, 30 games, because what could very well happen, let's say that they get off to a tremendous start and they're hot, they may step back and reevaluate and say, do we really want to tinker
mm-hmm.
with our chemistry right now? As talented as James Harden is, do we want to tinker with that by, you know, you talk about not stop, but if you move one of their really good role players who's contributing right now and doesn't need the basketball as much as James is going to require, because you got two guys in Paul George and Kawhi Leonard, they're going to need the ball. Mm-hmm. And so it'll be an interesting time. I'll be watching it closely to see what happens.
Yeah, and it's funny, even going back to Embiid, and these are things that I've always asked you just in our various travels. A name like Joel Embiid comes up, a name like Donovan Mitchell comes up, regardless of whatever team you're on or you're thinking about making a deal for, the question you've always come back to me and said, is he a number one guy on the championship team? Is he going to be the guy that carries us over the top? I don't feel like there's that many guys, Scott, that you can definitively say that. And I'm not sure Joel Embiid, as MVP of the league, deserving MVP, that he's a guy that's a number one guy on a championship team.
See, now, Vinny, you're tapping in the old school. You sound like the old school us back in Detroit. I think anytime that is generally the thing that you got to decide in any trade that you're making. At the end of the day, no, again, this is irregardless of team place. This is Scott Perry's belief and philosophy. Does that trade make us better, and how much does it make us better in relation to what we're sending out? And so if you feel that way, because again, you don't have the benefit of knowing the end result of a trade.
Right.
When you make it, at the time you make it, it has to play out. So you got to feel comfortable enough that whatever you're sending out the door and whatever you're bringing back, through your evaluation process, that, oh, we're going to be a better basketball team and that we're going to take a step forward from whatever position you're in, whether it's a non-playoff team, a middling playoff team, or a team that's, you know, knocking at the door to get over that next hurdle to get to a championship. But I would say, even though Joel Embiid has not won a championship yet, man, he is awfully good, and he poses so many problems for opposing teams. You know, a player that is going to dictate, and this is the coach in me, is going to dictate an entire defensive schematic for that night when you play against him. That's a real impact player. The guy was just MVP of the league this past year. Multi-time All-Star, And for whatever the reason, they haven't been able to get over the hump. But he had, but every year he's there, you feel like they can be a, at least a conference finalist. So for me, I put him, you know, in that kind of framework, if you will. My biggest concern would be just, you know, at the time of the trade, you know, how old will he be? What is his body like? The injury, because, you know, when you're talking about a big body like that, you know, that's a concern. But that, you know, look, that's going to be a concern in about any trade you make, that you want to make sure that that guy's going to be, you're hoping that he's going to be healthy for the term that you're going to have him there. So, again, a lot of thinking that goes into it. Terrific player. I'm sure that Philadelphia wants to keep him there. And it's just a side to me that Joel Embiid, at least in reading some of the things he says, part of him may want to be that one of those, you know, rare guys that plays his entire career where he was drafted. So we don't know how important that is to him. You know, right. I think, again, that's what's changed during my time in the NBA. A lot of the narrative has come, you know, I know some players may have started talking around this line, but just, but boy, it is really prevalent now. The guy's not winning. A lot of analysts, media talk, oh, he needs to get out of there. He needs to get traded to team A, team B. But so much goes into making that trade happen. We don't even know if the player want, you know, wants that to happen at the time. But it's just, again, it's a new era. And at the end of the day, we got to embrace it. And as front office people, you got to navigate it and react to it the best way you can.
And it's funny, you say you media people, Scott, you have to start including yourself in that. You work for ESPN.
You're going to be on TV with
Stephen A. Smith yelling at you. That will be a battle of beige rage when you and Stephen A. are yelling at each other, okay? So you have to start including yourself in this new media world. But you touched on something, and I know you're big on team building. Mm-hmm. So even before we go there, because we're both Detroiters, and the Pistons have started off 2-1. It's very, very early. It's very, very early. But it seems like their young talent is starting to put some things together, and they're playing competitive, energetic basketball. Are you surprised? Because I remember you were really high on Jalen Duren last year going into the draft, and he wound up going to Detroit as part of the trade for you guys to sort of clear some cap space. But just in a general sense, are you surprised that the team that you used to work for, you know, that they are starting to finally maybe return to relevance in the Eastern Conference?
A, not surprised. B, I'm happy that they're off to a fast start for a variety of reasons. You know, you talked about Duren, Beef Stew, as all of you Detroiters call him now. Those guys on the front line are setting the tone, like we talked about with the teams that we had when I was working there with the Pistons, and obviously the teams prior to that, the Isaiah Thomas and Joe Dumars, Bad Boys Pistons. But again, they're taking a page out of that book in terms of how they're competing. They're playing physical. They're playing tough. They're very athletic as a group. And I really like that, especially in today's game, because, you know, everybody talks about playing fast and pace and space. They're going to have the athletes to play that way. And as they learn, I think what you're going to watch now, you've got a lot of 1 and 2 year guys. And then they have a couple very good veterans like Alec Burks and Bogdanovich,
yeah,
has not played yet, but he'll be a very good veteran to have around as well. And I think Monty Morris they picked up, who's another solid veteran, that would be helpful to their cause. But a lot of first and second year players, well, I know Cade, this is year three for him now. But between Cade and Jaden Ivey, the two we just mentioned, Stewart and Duren, the kid Osua Thompson, most nights they should not lose the energy and effort battle, because they're going to be young, active, Ausar Thompson, I think, has a chance to be an elite defender in this league.
He strikes me as an Iguodala type of player.
No question. And you know, a lot of times people focus on what a player can't do coming in the door. The one thing that he doesn't do as well right now in terms of is shooting the basketball, but that's the one skill that I've always believed and watched over time, even before I started working in the
NBA. That's the easiest skill to get, right?
Yeah, players are going to get better over time because they're shooting every single day. They're working on it. They're playing so many games. That's going to come down the line for him. But he's able to get on the floor now because, hey, he doesn't need the basketball to be impactful. They're already challenging him now to defend multiple positions on the floor.
Mm-hmm.
And he's accepting that challenge. You know, he can be very impactful offensively in transition. And even when they get to the half court as a lob threat, back cutting, there's a lot of things that he can do. I think this year it's going to be big to watch Cade Cunningham's development.
If he's good, then the franchise has a chance.
Right.
If you know he gets hurt again, or if he turns out not to be as good, and the early returns look like he's legit. If that makes this whole rebuild thing for Troy Weaver, who you know you've been close with for you know decades, that makes this thing a lot more real. If you got him right, if you get that number one pick right, Then that makes all the other corresponding pieces that much easier to fit.
That there's no question about it. First piece that you mentioned about him staying healthy, that's going to be key. Can he navigate an 82 game season healthy? Because again, if you're going to build your franchise around someone, his best ability is availability. And so that's one thing that he's going to have to demonstrate this year, in my opinion, for that basketball team. And then a lot of falls on his plate too, not only his play, but because of where he's drafted and because he's going to have a ball in his hand a lot, what's his leadership going to be like? What's his interaction with his teammates going to be like? You know, can he develop into a good enough two-way player? I think he needs to improve defensively, and that's going to be big. I'm a long believer in when you're talking about putting someone as the focal point of your franchise, the player needs to be a two-way player. Now, he doesn't, again, we're in an offensive age, and obviously that is huge and it's important. The player needs to be able to shoot, score the basketball. I get that. But he has to be at least match up with his position on a nightly basis where he's not a negative on the defensive end. He doesn't have to be all defensive team. He doesn't have to be an elite stopper. But can he just match up with his position well enough and can he become a very good team defender?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
I think that's what's, you know, not to jump off the Pistons, but I think that's what quietly Steph Curry has done over his run. You know, there was a lot of questions about him defensively early on.
Yeah.
But I watched him again just last night. He's improved as a defender every year, and he's smart player. He's always been in a good position from a team standpoint so that your team defensive scheme and dynamic is not compromised. And that's hugely important. You know, obviously Draymond and Klay Thompson are the individual stalwarts defensively, and Andrew Wiggins has a good defensive component as well, but he's that. So
for Cade,
Steph has become that.
Steph
but now
Cade,
has to at least be that, and he's a bigger player than Steph. So, and I haven't had a chance to look at his rebound numbers, but he's going to need to rebound the basketball well.
Yeah,
For his size, that'll be a good component for him. And I'm just excited to watch this team grow. I think Monty Williams is going to do a very good job as head coach. Got a lot of experience. It's a great challenge for him to really, you know, polish these guys up because the tools are there. And they're just going to, you know, when they hit that adversity, which I don't care if you're a good team, middle team, bad team, you're going to hit it. How do they handle it? And then that's at that time, we need to get together and talk then and see how it's being handled. You're going to learn more about Cade. You're going to learn more about all the good young talented players there and kind of where they sit at the current time.
Now, Scott, you just volunteered yourself to come back onto the podcast. I just want you to know that this is officially on wax. I'm gonna get next time we get Scott, he's gonna be Scott P Unplugged. Okay, y'all are getting the very nice and polished version of Scott Perry. We're gonna get to it.
Scott, you know I'm a rookie on this side. Like you said,
That's true. I'm a media now,
but I'm a rookie. So I'm learning. So I'm coming to you, veteran. Like I counseled you when you was stepping over to the covering the NBA. So now I'm relying on you, Vinny, to counsel me.
I got you. Trust me, as long as you don't slouch in your chair. Like that's the one thing I do not slouch in your chair when you are on TV. No, you're not. You're not. But when you were watching games,
because I remember that exactly.
when you were watching games, you would be slouch, and I'd be like, I couldn't tell if you were mad or if you were just intense. And Scott would just—he just has this thing where he would slouch in his chair, and I'm like, look, if you're gonna do TV, if you're gonna do media, gotta have that. You gotta sit up all the way right, back straight, and everything else. So one last thing, Scott. I don't know if you know this.
Mm-hmm.
You were one of the few people, I can't remember an executive being traded for draft picks.
I forgot all about that.
Scott came over to Sacramento from Orlando, and then the Knicks job came up. So because he was, you know, under contract and just gotten there, you know, there had to be compensation. So you were traded for a second round pick and cash considerations, which I actually don't know what cash considerations actually means. That's just a very vague term. Does that mean they trade y'all a laptop or or a printer or something?
That's so long ago. And you brought something up that I had totally forgotten about. And but I'm, you know, just thankful for my experience both in Sacramento and in New York. So,
well, before you left Sacramento, you drafted De'Aaron Fox.
Yes.
Right?
Yeah, man, I'm always pleased to see young people grow and develop and really start to reach their potential. You know, he was someone that obviously we were very high on, tremendous young man, and he endured some tough years. Learned, you know, again, just like we were talking about with the Piston team, as a young player, you got to, like I used to, the analogy all the time, like running track, you got to go around the track a couple times. That means when I say around the track once in the NBA, usually that's a season.
Mm-hmm.
So you go
mm-hmm.
around a couple times. So when you start playing in all these different arenas, really learning the personnel that you're going to be playing against, it's different than watching guys on television when you're in college and saying, oh, okay, yeah, I can go play this guy or whatever. But when you start playing them in an NBA arena, it's a little bit different. And so to watch De'Aaron grow like he has, man, and how he's playing. And I watched him last night. Terrific player. Couldn't be happier for him. And happy for the Kings, man. They're doing, you know, a lot of expectations this year.
Scott, I guess if we got time, we probably got a couple more minutes. Having worked in Detroit, having worked in New York, tell me the difference in outside expectations. As far as the basketball market, as far as what the fans expect, how they expect to win, how quickly they expect to win. Is there a difference? Like, I've lived in New York for a couple of years, and I didn't realize how much of a basketball town it was. If you don't live in Detroit, you don't know how desperate of a basketball town it is. And you've worked in both of those places. So what's the difference, or is there a difference?
Well, I just think there's a difference in the national attention that comes with it. But yeah, growing up as a Detroiter, and I loved having those expectations working for my home team in Detroit. And, you know, knowing a lot of people in the community and people always engaged and wanting to talk about the team. And I was there during that decade from 2000 to 2010 when we were highly successful, as you well know. It was a joy. And so we used to go play in New York a lot prior to me going there. So, you know, there was always a special feel going into the Garden as a visiting team.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, there was something to that. And then, you know, once I started working there, the passion, I think the knowledge of the fan base is terrific. And they're going to let you know that they know about what's going on and what they see. And there was oftentimes I was would be stopped, you know, by fans just in, you know, even to this day, you know, where I live at now in Florida, a lot of New York people, they love the Knicks and are pulling for the Knicks. And they are intense. And look, they want to see a winner, want to see a champion come back there. And hopefully one day that happens for them. You know, I'd love to see it because I'm sure that that town would be turned upside down if and when that does happen.
Look, Scott. Two things that we ain't never gonna see, okay? We ain't gonna see the Knicks win a championship. We ain't gonna see the Lions win a Super Bowl, okay?
Oh,
we can
finally, you trying to get Detroiters to turn off your podcast.
Look,
I admit,
they know my heart. I am happy for Lions fans, Scott.
Right.
That's what I'll say. I'm happy for Lions fans. But I quit. I turned my papers in July 27th, 1999, and I'm not coming back. Scott, you've been married for 30 years, right? We didn't have relationship discussions before. And you know, when I'm done, I'm done.
So
excuse me, 37 years.
Mm-hmm.
My bad. Apologies. Yeah. Apologies to your wife. Okay. I don't need them problems. Okay.
Exactly.
But Scott, really appreciate you coming on with me. The next time you come on, we're gonna really get into the weeds. We're going to talk about the Fab Five. We're going to talk about Glenn Big Dog Robinson giving you guys 37 and 35, whatever it was when he was at Purdue. We're going to talk about you drafting Kevin Durant. We just setting the table here because I want you to return as a guest, so I had to be nice to you today. But no, I really appreciate you coming on, P.
Look, you know, I definitely would love to come back and again, keep doing your thing. I mean, I really love to see your growth in this space, man. And you do a terrific job at it. I wish you nothing but the best. And I'll come back on here and I'm going to give you a harder time next time too.
I can't wait on it. I'm waiting. When Scott Perry gets TV experience under his, you know, under his belt, he going to come back on here. He going to be firing back at me. I look forward to you. Appreciate you again.
I'm looking forward to that too, Benny. Because if people, the public will get a chance to see what we've been doing for years behind the scenes anyway.
That's true. Trust me. We're probably going to talk right after this Zoom call. But Scott Perry, really appreciate you. You're going to see him all over every ESPN platform on the NBA this year with their new revamped Countdown crew. And even on NBA Today, where you're going to see him with Malika. So you can look forward to that. And behind the glass today, producer John, Evan and Ron, who put the videos together. We really, really appreciate you. Don't forget, Zach Lowe joins Dan Devine on another episode of Devine Intervention later this week on Ball Don't Lie. And I'll be back on Wednesday for another episode, a solo episode of The Good Word with Goodwill. Until then, everybody, be safe.